coming to you direct from the heart of New York City, all the way to wherever you are, you're listening to the VIP Jazzwall Report. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, and let me start by saying it really doesn't take long to live life, does it? When we look back at our lives, time just seems to have flown by. And based on that, many of you have requested that I do a show on midlife crisis. And as far as I'm concerned, midlife is when you finally get your head together, but your body starts to fall apart. I've been told by my wife to act my age many times, but in my defense, I don't know how to, because I've never been this age before. And at this stage of our lives, many of us seem to be getting glum about what we haven't become. But never before in our lives have we been so enriched with access to personal resources like wisdom, education, experience, independence. And you know, in our young days, we were fearless. Nowadays, we are fearful. Midlife is a natural development, but some see it as a dilemma. So to break it down, I have on the show today someone who I like to call the sage of today's age. He's known to billions and he's followed by millions. He's deeply impacted lives around the world with his yoga programs that enable one to self-discover and self-empower through what he calls inner engineering. He's in the Guinness Book of Records for planting 800,000 trees in 3 days with the help of 200,000 volunteers. And ironically, he's planted seeds of thoughts in people's minds so that they can develop a better foundation towards a better understanding of their lives. He's spoken at the United Nations, the World Economic Forum, the House of Lords in the United Kingdom. He truly is one of the most influential people in the world today. It's an honor to welcome back to the show the one, the only, Sadhguru himself. Welcome back, Sadhguru.
Thank you, Whip. You are very generous with your words.
I wish my wife was, you know. But I've missed you ever since we did our last show 6 months ago. I've had repeated requests from listeners to have you back. And most of these requests were from women. So at least we have something in common. We are both objects of desire.
No. I'm not an object of desire. Probably.
Well, I tell you what.
People see me as a solution.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And, you know, today we want to talk about this whole new age terminology called a midlife crisis. And, Sadhguru, you know, I see you in two forms. I see you one as a guru and the other as a human being called Jaggi Vasudev. And I wanted to ask you, has Jaggi Vasudev ever suffered from a midlife crisis?
Well, I'm not yet at midlife. I'm still at the beginning of my life, so there is really no crisis. But let me make this clear. Mm. Today, it's become a fashion to be a crisis.
Yes, it has.
You say adolescence. People say adolescence is a crisis and a problem.
Right.
And post that, being a young man or woman and seeking careers and partners and stuff, that is one kind of crisis.
Mm-hmm.
When all that settles, because it's settled in midlife, that is a crisis. And old age, of course, is a crisis. Death is crisis. So I'm saying crisis is not the nature of life. Crisis is the nature of some people's minds. They have made themselves like that. They experience everything as crisis.
Mm-hmm.
For most people, when they were very young, the problem was, their crisis was that they did not know. There was no familiarity with many things. Now, the midlife crisis is just reverse, that they're suffering the familiarity now.
Yeah.
At that time, they suffered the newness of things. Now, they're suffering the familiarity that's around them. So, crisis is not the quality of life. Crisis can become the quality of your mind if you do not manage that.
And what I see around me is, you know, the struggle for identity, the reclaiming of self-confidence. It's almost like the second form of puberty. You were mentioning adolescence. But what I've seen with a lot of people is an inner conflict of desire versus destination, of what we want versus where we are. And, you know, a lot of them seem dissatisfied at their present destination because they feel that they've not fully realized their desire, their inner feeling sort of haunts them. And it says to them that life could have been different if things were different, you know, different marriage partner, different job. And how and what is the best way to manage the reality of the situation you're in?
See, the desire, if one looks at it, essentially is a consequence of the circumstances in which we exist. In the sense, see now you live in America and if your neighbor has a big car, you want a bigger car or two of the kind.
Yes.
Suppose you were in some remote society and your neighbor had a big buffalo, I'm sure you would want a bigger buffalo or maybe two buffaloes for one that he had. So I'm saying what you desire for, the content of your desire, is essentially a consequence of the circumstances in which you exist. And because of this, it doesn't matter how many desires have been fulfilled, still there is one desire that is not fulfilled, and that's the nature of the desire. It doesn't matter if a million desires are fulfilled, still there will always be one desire that's not fulfilled, and that can make one miserable. So understanding the nature of the desire itself has not happened. What desire is about is, there is something within us which wants to expand in a boundless way. And this is finding expression in the form of desire. If you know only money, you will desire for more money. If you know wealth, knowledge, more knowledge, love, more love, pleasure, more pleasure, whatever you know, whatever may be your currency, but all that's happening is you're seeking expansion. But how much expansion, if you sincerely look at it, you will see you want limitless expansion. So the very nature of the desire is such that there will always be one desire unfulfilled. So if one does not understand the nature of the desire, one does not delve into the foundations or the origin of desire, then every time in life they think that time is crisis, or they always look back and think the past was better because they have forgotten many sufferings of the past. The detail of the past may be not stark in their memory.
Right. And the, you know, the other thing I also sort of... Are you saying that we should actually remove the concept of desire?
Desire is not a concept. Whether you like it or you don't like it, if you want to remove the concept of desire, what you are saying is you want to be desireless. I don't want desires is also a desire, and it'll always be an unfulfilled desire.
Yeah, because I see a lot of people in their own way depressed. And I've always told them, you know what, you don't measure your life by the dreams that don't come true. You measure them by the nightmares that don't come alive.
That's a very negative way of looking at life, Whip. What happened to you?
It's not a negative way, because
Life been whipping you up, what?
No, not at all. It's not negative, sir, because I'm going to measure them by the nightmares that don't come alive. That's actually positive.
But why do you have nightmares? I don't have any.
You don't have any?
No.
Well, that's why we desire to be you, but is desire a good thing then?
No. See, instead of looking at it this way, we are debating about the consequences. When I say consequences, I'm saying a mind which is in a certain way produces certain consequences.
Right.
The consequences of an out-of-control mind may be either nightmares or desires, okay? Dreams or desires, both of them, positive dreams and negative dreams, which you call as nightmares, both are a consequence of a mind which does not take instructions from you. If only your mind took instructions from you, you would conduct yourself in absolute sync with the reality in which you exist.
Right.
So I'm saying it is negative not because of the nightmare. Even the dreams are negative, I'm saying. The thing is, if we have consciously dreamt or desired something, that this is what I want to get to, that is different. But your dreams are always as a consequence of what somebody else is doing around you. So it is a compulsive dream. These compulsive dreams are constantly changing by the day. So by the time you fulfill one thing, the next thing is already on. But if we look at ourselves as a generation of people, I would say almost everybody in this generation, except a few unfortunate areas of the world where it is in war or strife or some other kind of, physical situation, generally a large part of the human population is better off than ever before. But they're whining like never before.
That's right. So, I mean, how does one then stop dreaming?
So you don't have to... See, when you say dreaming, the dream is a question of, is it a conscious way of you wanting to create your future? Is a dream, has a dream become the basis of a plan?
Mm-hmm.
Or is dream just an empty dream looking at somebody else, you want to be like them?
Right.
So but if it's a compulsive dream, every time it keeps changing. If it's a conscious dream, you will try to manifest, you will plan, you will work towards it, and you will look at various realities which will support that to create that. So when we say, I have a dream, is it a conscious dream that you have created as a way of projecting into the future so that you will be able to create it? A dream means when we consciously dream, it is a blueprint of tomorrow that we have drawn in our mind.
Mm-hmm.
If that is so, that is fine. But most people's desires are changing every day as somebody else has something, they want to have the same thing, and it is an endless process of suffering.
Right. Talking about suffering, happiness is not a loyal emotion. It doesn't stay with us for very long. What is it about negativity that prevails within our souls? Why are we constantly attracted to fear? Why, you know, it's a very loyal emotion.
See, it is not that emotions are either loyal or unloyal or disloyal. The question is not even about happiness or fear or suffering or grief or joy. The question is just this. Who you are, the way a human being is, one way of looking at it, one of the simplest way of understanding this is, for every human emotion that you go through, there is a chemical basis to it. What you call as peace is one kind of chemistry. What you call as joy is another kind of chemistry. What you call as ecstasy is another kind of chemistry. Agony is one kind of chemistry. Anxiety, another. Stress, another. Every emotion has a chemical basis to it. Or in other words, who you are is a chemical soup. The question is only, are you a great soup or a lousy soup? So, if I give 10 people the same soup-making ingredients, do you believe that they will all turn out with the same kind of soup? They will turn out with 10 different kinds of soups.
Right.
That's all that's happened right now. All of us are fundamentally the same kind of, the same ingredients. But look at the way each individual has become. So this is because our education systems, the way children are brought up today in the world, there is nothing about turning inward. There is nothing about a deeper understanding of yourself. We are too busy trying to fix the world. Well, we have fixed the world quite a lot, but we have done nothing about the individual human being. In the fundamental essence, we have done nothing about this because our current education systems and the social circumstances are not at all focusing upon this. So we have everything in our lives, but within ourselves, experientially, we don't know how to put it together. But physically, materially, aren't we living way better than any generation ever upon this planet?
Way better, way better. But, like you said before, there's a lot of depression, a lot of anger, a lot of confusion, a lot of doubt within people, more so than ever.
Bad soup.
Bad soup. Not as delicious as you and me.
I can... your wife is complaining about you.
That's because she puts the wrong ingredients when she's making me. You know, in one of your videos, you said that being too good is a sickness. I wonder if you remember that.
being too
good is a sickness.
No, no. What I said is, see, from where do you come to the conclusion that you are good? You look at a few people around you, and looking at them, if you label them as bad, that is how you become good, because without a context, you are incapable of knowing whether you're good or bad. Suppose you are the only human being on this planet, you would not know whether you're good or bad. So I said, if you're joyful,
yeah,
if you're sensible and joyful, you can be trusted as to how you will behave. Because any human being, if you meet them, when they are feeling wonderful within themselves, they will naturally be wonderful to everything and everybody around them. When they are feeling nasty, when they are feeling frustrated, when they are feeling fearful, when they are feeling depressed, then they want to share their misery with somebody. They will in some way behave in which other people experience as nasty. But whenever a human being is feeling very pleasant within himself or herself, you will see they will always be wonderful to everybody around them. So goodness comes in comparison. What is in comparison is only a social reality of a kind, but somewhere else it will not work. And when I said being good doesn't work because good people who think they're good people, they have done terrible things, thinking they're doing the good thing. And in the world, if you look at it, what is the fight about? You know, like if you think you are a good this, you are fighting with somebody who's good something else. So whether it is between nations or races or religions, what is the fight? The fight is you are a good you are a good person identified with one thing and somebody else is identified with something else. Both of them believe they're very good, but they cause havoc on the planet. But you will see when a human being is joyful and sensible, you will see he will cause least amount of damage to this world.
But you see, you do good to so many people. You have so many followers. You enlighten people. You empower people. If you can't use that same philosophy and then say you're bad.
See, I'm not doing any good to anybody. I'm just doing what's natural to me. It's like suppose this is mango season in India. You're missing it, Vip.
I know. I'm terribly missing it. But I've got you.
If you go to your mango tree, it generates enormous amount of sweetness.
Yes.
Not out of its goodness, simply because that's its nature. So instead of functioning out of our humanity, we are trying to function out of our morality. That's what I meant when I said your goodness causes serious damage to people because your goodness is coming from certain values and morals that you've taken on. Instead of stirring up your humanity, you are trying to stick to morality. And when you take strong moral stance, you could do terrible things thinking that you're doing good things.
So is it better for other people to say that you are good rather than you to think of yourself as good?
That's very essential. You never think that you are good or bad. You see what is the best thing you can do right now with your life. And it is for the world to say, okay, he's done good or bad.
And at this point of people's lives in the so-called midlife, how does one take recharge of their life? Because there seems to be a lot of confusion combined with depression. You know, a lot of women out there, the kids have grown up, they've gone to college, they're confused about who they are anymore, where they're going. They've dedicated their lives to the family. And then now they question how to live their life.
See, life is a continuous changing circumstance. People are always trying to anchor themselves into something or the other. But at the same time, if they successfully anchor themselves and they become stagnant, there is no movement, they will feel depressed. If there is movement, they will feel fear. Because movement means you are constantly moving into unknown terrain. Stagnation means life feels suffocated and you feel depressed. So fundamentally, I'm saying very fundamentally, in a very fundamental level, there has been no instruction, no guidance as to how to look at life, how to approach life from within. Not as a man, not as a woman, but as a life. How, in what kind of circumstances will this life blossom into its fullest possibility? What kind of atmosphere, what kind of chemistry, what kind of experience do we have to hold within us to allow this life to go towards its natural blossoming? This knowledge is missing. This awareness is missing. So this we are thinking is happening because kids went to college. No, when they were in school also we suffered. When they were toddlers also we suffered something or the other.
Mm-hmm.
At every point, whether it is wet napkin or you know, the injuries at the school or something else, and now they're gone and they're on their own, now also we suffer. So suffering is not at this point, at that point. People are suffering this mainly not because of the quality of their life, simply because of the quality of their mind. That is what needs to be worked at.
And you mentioned two key words, you know, when you were just telling me. You mentioned instruction and guidance. Where to go for instruction and how to get guidance?
I'm hollering from the rooftops, haven't I?
Yes. But I guess you know what...
I see that there is such a vacuum.
Hmm.
Everybody is trying to provide solutions which are at the most, I would say, piecemeal. There is no homogeneity to what is being said around in the world. So one thing that I want to contribute, one thing that I'm trying to bring to the space is, as a part of this, we are releasing a book in America, is to make people understand that you are a piece of life. If you turn inward and experience the nature of life that you are, everything that you need to know about this life, you will know. It's not by instruction. It is not by, I know you use that word, not by reading a book. I know I have just now said we are releasing a book, but fundamentally by turning inward and experiencing the nature of the life that you are, only then there is a homogeneity to everything that you do. Otherwise, it's piecemeal. You take on one tidbit from here, one bit from there, and try to make a whole out of it. It doesn't work like that. We must understand, first of all, what we call as our mind. Whatever information and knowledge that we have is just a few pieces of the larger jigsaw. With a few pieces, if you make sense, you really lost it, isn't it?
Yep. Very much so. But I guess what people are looking for, I guess, you know, people want the easy way out. They want the answer to be told to them. But the way you're telling me, it's almost like you search within your soul versus...
No, I didn't mention that word, huh?
Okay, that's fine. You know, it's just my limited vocabulary. But I guess it's just finding yourself, who you are within the larger context of where you are. But I guess people are looking for purpose in their lives. So when people come to you with that dilemma, how do you manage their expectation of them finding their purpose?
See, people are not looking for purpose. People are not looking for some destination. If they were truly blissful and joyful, they would not need a purpose. Just being alive is a good enough purpose.
But you need something to make you joyful, don't you? If I just start laughing at nothing, my wife's going to throw me out twice.
Now, the thing is, whatever experience happened in your life, whether it's joy or misery, it happens from within. It doesn't happen from outside. The choice is only this. Either your experiences are the stimuli for your experiences are outside, or the stimuli for your experiences is within. Or to put it simply, either your experiences or let's say your joy is either on push start or self start. I'm talking about upgrading your technology that your joyfulness, your blissfulness, your love, everything is on self-start, that if you sit here, you're capable of experiencing these things because anyway they come from within. They don't rain upon you from outside. It is just that you may be looking for outside help. But what I'm trying to tell you is, this life, you as a life, is a complete life. Nobody told you it's half a life and it needs support from outside. In physical existence, we may be interdependent, but in the inner dimension, we are not interdependent. This life is complete by its own nature. So if we realize the full potential of this, being joyful, being miserable, you understand, is completely happening from within. And if you understand this, and if you know the seat of your experience, from where the experience is being generated from within, once you have a grasp of that, you will definitely create pleasant experiences for yourself. You will not create unpleasantness. So, a pleasant experience, when I say pleasantness, if you're pleasant in your body, we call this health.
Right.
If it becomes very pleasant, we call this pleasure. If you're pleasant in your mind, we call this peace. If it becomes very pleasant, we call it joy. If you're pleasant in your emotion, we call this love. If you become very pleasant, we call this compassion. If your very life energies become pleasant, we call this bliss. If it becomes very pleasant, we call it ecstasy. If your surroundings become pleasant, then we call this success. Now, you repeatedly going back to your domestic situation is the last one, success.
Mm-hmm.
Success needs cooperation. Success needs skill to harness the forces around us. But for the first four levels of pleasantness, it just takes a little deeper perception of who we are. When I say who we are, I'm not talking about you as a person, but I'm talking about you as life.
You're talking about perception of who we are, and I want to take that to another part of the so-called midlife dilemma, is people seem to be having a lot of doubt over their spouses, in that have they ever loved their spouse? There seems to be a resentment over the marriage. Either people have changed for the worse according to them, or people have just or the spouses have become sort of self-centered and things like that. How does one sort of reconnect the marriage, or should they even bother?
So this is something that a whole lot of people are experiencing in today's world, because variety of things have changed in our lives. There was a time when a woman would be right through her reproductive age, she would be having children, so she was just kept busy all the time.
Yep.
She had no other possibility in her life. And there was no education, there was no economic freedom. All those things have changed today. So, unless you behave, she's not going to stay with you.
That's true.
So, in a way, the entire business of managing a family might have become little more, what to say, for lack of vocabulary, I would say challenging, because a woman is looking at her own fulfillment, her own what she wants. And I don't see there's anything wrong with that. It is just that it is the first, second generation which is beginning to handle that aspect. So many of them who belong to another time may be struggling with that. But at the same time, two people come together at a certain age. Let us say at 20, a couple came together, and at that time, what brought them together could have been their physical and emotional needs. And now it is at 40 or 45, those physical and emotional needs have dramatically changed. They are not the same anymore. Unless both the people have changed in similar ways, which is hard to manage, which needs a lot of symphony to both of them change in a similar manner, now you see some kind of discord. So one important thing that every couple need to understand is, it's very difficult for two people to grow exactly at the same pace in the same direction. That is unrealistic to expect that. So it's important that husband and wife develop interests other than in each other, that you have some interests that keeps you engaged and involved, and both the people learn to appreciate each other's interests. We may not be interested in what they're interested, but we appreciate, so that we still have a meeting point, which is not gone in most people. They still have a meeting point, they still have common things, but so many things are different. If we don't appreciate this, that people grow at different pace, two people cannot grow at the same pace and in the same directions, if we appreciate that, this shouldn't be a crisis. But unfortunately for a lot of people, it by the time they realize that, already, you know, a war zone has developed.
Oh yeah, it has developed, and you know, the crisis starts to take different forms in divorce and adultery. And, you know, adultery now has become more common than before, and is actually one of the greatest causes for divorce. But
I think that word is out of vogue now, Vip.
Which one?
Adultery.
What should it be called?
Just an affair.
Just an affair, okay. You're absolutely right. Okay, so society and you know, sometimes even religion, they accuse the adulterer of wrongdoing. But, you know, you and me, we have a great respect for science. Newton's law says that for every action, there's a reaction. And let's take this to adultery. Adultery usually happens, or an affair usually happens, when one spouse fails to show maybe or initiate the love that's required to maintain the emotional bond or the physical bond. So the other spouse might run out of patience and conduct the affair. Why do we blame the reaction and never the action? You know, it's always the person who has the affair is the one who's the wrong one.
That is because a certain, you know, people have taken a vow in whatever, in health and illness, in success and failure.
Yeah, for better, for worse and all that, yep.
Yes. So because of that vow, and without that vow, two people, whether you take it in a religious manner or within yourself or between the two of you, unless there is some commitment, unless there is a strong commitment, two people staying together for a long period of time is very difficult, because this is one kind of relationship. Generally, this man-woman or this husband-wife relationship is one relationship where there is too much overlap of two lives. Everything you will have to share, from the physical spaces to bedroom to bathroom to your bodies, and everything you will have to share. So when there is so much sharing, there has to be some pleasantness of emotion. If we don't maintain that pleasantness of emotion, that sharing can become very bitter. And it could become vengeful enmity, because sharing is very difficult to do when the necessary pleasantness of emotion is not there. So how to maintain this? There are many other balls to juggle. People are after their careers, there are children, maybe there are health issues, and there are other social challenges. Managing all these things, they may not be able to be perfect lovers to each other. In that, you know, dislocations can happen. These are consequences of the life we have chosen to live as modern societies.
But if in your philosophy, do we have to stick to the life that we have chosen to live? Because all the dynamics, including time, change as we progress.
We can choose differently, but every choice, new choice that you make, has its own consequences. All I'm saying is, whether you stick to your old choices or make new choices, can you do it joyfully? If you are going to be miserable doing this or that, then you better stick to where you are.
Yeah, every new level has a new devil.
I don't know who is living in your neighborhood, huh?
Well, it's not you, so you're welcome to move in. There's a house next door for sale. In your inner engineering programs, How do you build and help people in using their minds to create or become what they want?
So in our engineering program, the fundamental aspect is this. We give them a very powerful process, an inward-looking process, which will change the chemistry of who you are. Today I can proudly say there are millions of people across the world, if they close their eyes in the morning, tears of ecstasy will drip every day for them. So there is such pleasantness of experience. When you are in a pleasantness of experience, see, when you're very happy, you're flexible. When you're very happy, you're pleasant to everything around you. This will transform your relationships. This will transform the way you work. This will transform your ability to do things. There is substantial medical and scientific evidence to show you that when you're in a pleasant state of experience, your body and mind functions at its best. So the basic inner engineering program is just focused towards this, to give you a chemistry of blissfulness.
You're almost...
It is not a teaching, it is not a philosophy, it is a method that you can learn to use.
And this method is something that takes in the form of, say, yoga?
This is a 30-hour process. I mean, yoga is fine because the word yoga, how I use it and how it is used today, particularly in the American society, is very different because people think yoga is a practice. Yoga means union. When I say union, in some way you have learned to erase the boundaries of your individuality. How you do it, there are many, many methods to do it, but in some way you have erased. That means you have become a more open-ended life. And so being a closed box which is suffocating, you have become an open-ended life, you're breathing better, you're experiencing life better simply because you have managed to erase the boundaries of your individual nature.
And you obviously practice this yourself.
I live it, I don't practice it.
What does your daily routine look like?
Oh, if I sleep in the same bed two nights, that is a luxury for me. So where is the question of a routine? Every day I'm traveling.
But does your body have a body clock?
No, I go by the world clock.
You go by the world clock, but like what time do you get up in the mornings?
See, if I'm home, let's say, if I'm back in India or here in Tennessee, it's very natural for me if I will not go to bed before 12:30, 1 o'clock. If I go somewhere around that time, then it's very natural for me to wake up around 3:30, 3:40.
Wow.
It has always been so for me. I just wake up at that time and do a few things, and if necessary, I may rest a little while. Otherwise, I get into activity immediately. But most of the time, almost, let's say, 250 days in a year, I'm traveling, so I'm in different time zones. So there is no particular time as such.
So, you know,
on average, I sleep... almost 25 years, I slept only 2.5 hours per day on an average. These days, I'm getting little lazy and sleeping anywhere between 4 to 4.5 hours.
Wow. That is wow. So how do you manage? Because you're traveling everywhere, you're busy, you've got books coming out, you're doing seminars, you're speaking at events. You're busier than anyone else. And yet, you know, when you meet people, everyone comes to you with some element of dissatisfaction that they need you to resolve or help them with and things like that. How do you achieve balance in your hectic life?
Balance is not something that you achieve. If you become very malleable, that you are not like a concrete block, you are like breeze. You will always be balanced. I'm like thin air, empty in my head. So So,
But then I think there's a bulletproof wall around that thin air, because if you're meeting someone who has a negative vibe, you don't let it get into your air. How do you do that?
No, I don't think of anything negative as positive. It is, see, right now you breathe out carbon dioxide, right?
Yep.
The tree doesn't think it's negative. It takes it in and makes life out of it. So this negative, positive stuff is all in our minds. Everything, everything is nourishing. Everything is well-being if you know how to imbibe it. So I don't, put up a bulletproof wall for anybody's negative anything. I'm able to gobble up the negativity and make it positive.
But how do you do that when you're in, say, a boardroom or you're meeting someone and you've come across a certain obstacle within your mission?
I don't see anything as an obstacle. There are situations.
Yep, okay.
There are situations which facilitate. There are situations which don't facilitate what you're trying to do.
So that's the first thing I've learned from you for this particular issue, is that don't identify it as a problem or an obstacle. Just identify it as an issue.
It is. I mean, when you say it's an issue, it's a problem too. I'm saying it's just another situation. Whenever you don't know how to handle a situation, you tend to label it as a problem. But we must understand this, what you think is a problem may not be a problem at all for somebody else. They'll just breeze through that situation. So it is just a situation. Instead of seeing how we can handle it, we are labeling it as a problem and making it an impediment in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one more situation. Some situations we know how to deal with, some situations we're yet to know how to deal with. But there is no situation that cannot be dealt with. It can be dealt with. Maybe right now we are not competent to deal with it, that's all.
And when you're in that situation, how do you handle that? When you feel maybe you're not competent enough to handle that particularly new situation?
If I see I'm not competent, I don't handle it.
You delegate.
I always delegate. But I'm saying, if I see I'm not competent to do something, I'm not stupid enough to try to prove something there. No, I will just tell people I don't know how to do this.
Now, this year, I mean, or in recent times, what do you feel is bothering people?
In the sense, I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
You know, you have the pulse on people's feelings. What do you sense they are feeling with all the recent things that are going on? Is there more depression than there is fear?
In America, I think right now it looks like wherever I go, people are worried about their politics.
Rightfully so.
In India, we have learned to live with our politics.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it's any better, but we've learned to live with that, seeing that this is how things are and how to make the best out of it.
Well, in September, which is also your birthday month, you've got a book coming out from Random House.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's called Inner Engineering, A Yogi's Guide to Joy.
Yes, it is.
What made you focus on joy?
As I said, joy is just another form of pleasantness. There is only this much in our lives. Either whatever is happening around us, we can make it into a pleasant possibility for ourselves or an unpleasant possibility. We can go on giving many exotic names to pleasantness and unpleasantness, but essentially this, what you call as heaven is pleasantness, what you call as hell is unpleasantness, isn't it? So the choice is just this within yourself. Do you want to be a living hell or do you want to be a heaven within yourself?
Mm-hmm.
So joy is one of those things. When you're joyful, everything feels like it's heaven. So this is an aspiration. This is not my idea. This is natural human aspiration. Everybody in some way is in pursuit of their joy or happiness. I think it's enshrined in this country's constitution, pursuit of happiness. But happiness is not the problem, pursuit is the problem, because when you say in pursuit of something, it is supposed to be hanging somewhere outside. But the source of all your experience, the seat of your experience is within you. It is for you to activate the seat of your experience to produce what you want. So inner engineering is looking at the simple technology through which you can make your experience of life the way you want it. I am not saying you must be joyful. If you like misery, do it. I have no issue. But you must be at least within you, what you want should be happening. The world will never happen 100% your way. But this one person that you call as myself, this person should be happening just the way you want this person to be. If I believe that if you happen the way you want yourself to be, you will choose to keep yourself joyful.
Well, I can't wait for the book to come out. And I've always wanted to ask…
First, we have produced over, 140 books till now, but all in India. Many of them are selling on Amazon. But this is the first book written for America.
Oh.
So, there is a certain amount of excitement, let's see.
Oh, and then you got to come back on the show and we got to discuss it. And do send me a copy, I want to read it, page to
Definitely.
Page.
Definitely, there is a galley copy right now which came out yesterday, maybe I'll send it to you.
Oh, please do. And you know what, I can never be you, but I can dress like you. I've always wanted to ask you, who does your wardrobe and where do you get those shawls from? I mean, what is it, silk, cashmere?
No, they're not cashmere. Cashmere is all, you know, whatever, that pashmina and all that, you have to kill the deer, which I don't do. Mostly what I wear is cotton and silk, and largely cotton, largely organic, handmade stuff. This is one mission that I took it up on the side, because I've been so familiar with the different weaves of India. India is one place where there are over 120 distinct weaves. Nowhere else on the planet this is possible. This has taken a few thousand years to evolve and develop.
Right.
In different regions of the country, there are different weaves. Many of these are dying away. Many of these are on the last edge of extinction because there's just one family doing this particular kind of weave. In another few years, it'll be gone.
No,
so
but
one
it
of
is...
the things that I took it up was to revive these weaves. So we call this Save the Weave.
But it is beautiful. I mean, the thread count, the richness and the way it flows, it's just amazing.
A certain imperfection, you know. Certain imperfection about doing with hand versus doing with machine.
Well, it looks
and,
great.
And above all, upon one's body, I know today everybody's buying clothes off the shelf, ready-made and synthetic stuff, everything easy to wash, whatever. They're using it. I would advise everybody to have at least 10% of your wardrobe, make it organic cotton, handmade, use it and see. Once you become sensitive to the feel of it, how your body feels, how your energy feels with it, then you will see this is the way to be. And anyway, about the wardrobe, I design my own clothes, so I don't have a designer as such.
Well, when you're going to throw away one set, you give me a call, I'll take it. But Sadhguru, we've come to the end of the show, and I hope to see you back to discuss the book. You know something? If I could even be 1% of who you are, which I'm not, I'd be twice the man I am today. So thank you for...
You must come to the Inner Engineering program in June. I will make you 10%, not
1%. Thank you for coming back, sir. I'm going to see you later this year and hopefully in June as well.
Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was The Profound Sadhguru. A special shout-out of thanks to Vinod Seetharaman, the wonderful Sona Alaikar Ahuja, and Beyond Media for making this show happen. And of course, I'd be nothing without my dream team, William Sanchez and Rick Buser. Your comments and your follow are so very welcome on my social media pages, and I wish you and your loved ones the very best in your journey of navigating life. And until next Sunday, have a productive and a very happy week ahead.